From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. African-American men continue to be disproportionately targeted by police all over the country. But the horrific stories of what has happened to men like Mike Brown and Philando Castile obscure the reality that Black women are also disproportionately targeted. In general, women of color and also transgender women are among the most vulnerable communities when it comes to policing and violence. Now a new book explores the stories of women who have been killed and how they are perceived by police. Andrea J. Ritchie is a Black lesbian immigrant and police misconduct attorney. She's a 2014 Senior Soros Justice Fellow with more than two decades of experience advocating against police violence and the criminalization of women and LGBTQ people of color. She's currently the researcher in residence on race, gender, sexuality, and criminalization at the Barnard Center for Research on Women, and the co-author of Say Her Name, Resisting Police Brutality Against Black Women, as well as Queer Injustice, the Criminalization of LGBT People in the United States. She joins me to discuss her newest book, Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. Welcome to the program, Andrea.
Thanks so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
Thanks so much for joining us. You open your book with a very personal set of incidents that took place when you were a very young woman that I'm assuming has really impacted and influenced the way you look at this issue. Can you share a little bit about your own background, some of the experiences you had that made it very clear to you from a young age that police were going to profile you in a particular way because of what they saw as a young woman of color, a young Black woman?
Well, what actually I found interesting is that that was very disconnected. My own experiences were very disconnected from my activism around policing. And I sort of filed them away as something bad that happened that taught me an important lesson that that I should not be counting on police to protect me, and that I should perceive them as much of a threat as anyone else, if not more, in my life. But I didn't connect that to my work around policing. And I think that's true for a lot of women involved and in leadership of movements to challenge racial profiling and police violence. And it was sort of when I was pushing my colleagues who were in leadership, my sisters who were in leadership of this movement, who would frequently be talking about their concerns for, you know, men in their families and their partners and their sons and their other men in their lives. And I would say, well, but what about you? Aren't you concerned about your own experiences? Why aren't you having the talk with your daughter? Why are we silent? And I would sometimes people would talk about their own experiences, but then I would say, well, but why are you not? Why is that not something that you center in your activism? People would sort of say, well, I don't know. It just doesn't seem like it's part of the conversation. So I just, when I was sitting down to write the book, kind of turned the question on myself and said, well, but wait, why have I never talked about this? Why is this something that I also have sort of set aside and come at the issue not from that place? And so it was a, sort of a response to my own challenge. And I think that, you know, for a long time, women of color have been the backbone of resistance to state violence. Harriet Tubman, Ida B. Wells, I mean, you can just, Sojourner Truth, you can just list, the list goes on and on. But we often, you know, our own experiences are often eclipsed in the movements that we lead. And I think that's changing a great deal. I think Black Lives Matter has changed that a great deal. I think in the moment post-Ferguson, we hit a watershed moment where women who are leading frontline movements around police violence and accountability refuse to be doing it only for other folks and not for themselves and their siblings and sisters. And I think that moment inspired me to follow suit.
And it is, of course, no surprise that the three founders of the Black Lives Matter movement are three Black women. Just as you were saying, Black women have been at the forefront historically of fighting back against racism and what Black women and women of color are facing from society. Today, police violence is such a huge issue, and we hear these really heartbreaking stories. One of the things that I want to hone in on, which you also hone in on in your book, is how Black mothers are policed. You know, we heard the terrifying story of Corinne Gaines, and there have been others like her, where a young Black mother with her children next to her is gunned down. How do police perceive Black mothers, and what it is about their perceptions that makes them think of Black mothers as such a big threat that they need to be shot?
There's a few things. I mean, I draw heavily on Dorothy Roberts' work in this area and on the work of the reproductive justice movement around how much Black motherhood, once it was not reproducing labor in a chattel slavery system, became deeply devalued, and how deeply devalued it was in that system as well. You know, Black motherhood was only valuable until the child, which then became property, was produced, and then, you know, mothers could be ripped from their children immediately, almost, or shortly thereafter, without any say on their part. And so, as part of that process, the notion that Black mothers had cared about their children, had attachments to their children, were good parents, were nurturers, had to be erased because otherwise it was intolerable to think of separating Black women from their children to sell them away. And so that was the root and justification for it. Later on, narratives evolved around Black motherhood being about reproducing deviance, about, you know, Black children being super predators and Black mothers being the producers of super predators, and that Black children and Black motherhood are being perceived as a threat to society. I think the welfare queen stereotype also produced that. And so as a result, we sort of forget how police internalize and reinforce and elaborate a lot of those theories and that they act on them. And so the book contains a lot of information about or cases of police officers explicitly committing violence against Black pregnant people and saying as they're doing it, "We don't like Black pregnant women. You're lucky I don't kill your baby," as they're harming Black pregnant women. We also see police officers policing Black motherhood and caretaking in ways that are very discriminatory and reflect similar perceptions of Black motherhood, that Black women aren't good mothers, that they're always neglectful, that they're always harming their children. And that plays out in terms of racial disparities in child welfare arrests and interactions with police officers and mothers. And then, you know, in the context of the war on drugs, also Black mothers who are or are perceived to be using drugs are treated much more harshly. One study showed, you know, sort of 10 times more likely to be arrested than white women, even though both groups of women are using drugs during pregnancy at the same rate. And so there's a lot of different ways that law enforcement and policing comes at Black mothers that we don't think about, when the usual way that we think about Black mothers in the context of policing is as grieving mothers, as mothers who have lost children, usually male children. And again, that's very true. It's a very important role that Black mothers have played. They've been, again, at the leadership of movements in that role. And we need to create space for all of us to pay more attention to the other ways in which they are affected by police violence and the ways they intersect.
You brought up the issue of drugs, and that's a really, really important story. The war on drugs, of course, disproportionately having impacted communities of color and African Americans. But we think often of Black men being criminalized by that system, and women are as well, right? I mean, this is a very, very important issue that impacts women and Black women and women of color. How important is it to highlight that women are also victims of the war on drugs? We just don't hear that often enough.
I completely agree. And I think particularly in this moment, as this current administration is signaling and already engaging in sort of an intensification of an already intensified war on drugs, that we need to pay particular attention as to how that war is waged on the bodies of Black women and women of color. And, you know, women have been the fastest growing prison population for four decades now, and their rate of growth in incarceration has outpaced the rate of growth of men by 50% over that period. And one of the main drivers has been drug-related offenses. And the stories that we were hearing more in the 80s and 90s, and where the society is paying less attention to them now, were of women who weren't playing a major role in the drug trade or were drug users, but because they couldn't give evidence to prosecutors to help them prosecute other people, because like in every other industry, Black women and women of color are at the lower levels usually of the industry and therefore don't have much information to trade, they're doing more time than the supposed kingpins that the drug war on drugs is supposedly going after, because they had little information or no information to trade, or they were involved in the trade at very low levels, or by force or coercion or through violent relationships. And so as the Attorney General Jeff Sessions talks about going back to prosecuting offenses to the maximum drug offenses to the maximum at the federal level, and unless people can turn over evidence on other people, we're going to see that number of women in prison under those circumstances rise, and the racial disparities that have persisted for Black women, even though they've decreased slightly, that Black women are still incarcerated at twice the rate of white women, will continue to exist. We also need to think about the ways the war on drugs is waged on Black women's bodies short of incarceration. So, for instance, recently a dash cam video was released of a 2015 very public strip search and vaginal cavity search that a young woman in Texas was subjected to. She had been stopped for failing to stop at a stop sign, so a typical sort of driving while Black stop. The officer claimed that he smelled marijuana on her, and as a result, you know, called a female officer to the scene who forced her to the ground, pulled down her pants, and sexually assaulted her for 11 minutes. And the woman talks about her experience of this as a public sexual assault. It is completely, such a search is completely unjustified under any law, any constitutional provision, and therefore constitutes a sexual assault under law. And that, unfortunately, is all too common. We've heard a little bit about it in the 90s in the context of Customs and Border Patrol doing that to Black women at airports and profiling Black women and Asian women at airports. But that happens in streets, in homes, and in our communities across the country. So that's another way in which we really need to think about this issue. And lastly, when officers can threaten you with long mandatory minimum drug sentences, it gives them a lot of power to extort sex from you. And this is another sort of dirty little secret of the war on drugs, is that officers use that and target women who are perceived to be using drugs or in the drug trade for sexual violence and assault, because they know that they're facing long sentences and criminalization.
Right. The issue of sexual violence is a really big part of this story that, of course, is specifically something that women face when they are at the whim of police power. And we see very different reactions to white women from police versus Black women and women of color in general, right? And I think that's a really important issue to acknowledge. Not that white women never get sexually assaulted by police, but I imagine the statistics bear out a disproportionate targeting of women of color.
Unfortunately, we have no official statistics on the issue of sexual violence by police officers, but what we do have is what people are able to collect from what's reported in the news or in criminal arrests or in civil cases. But what we do know from just hearing women's stories is that absolutely officers target young women, women of color, particularly Black women, women who are believed to be involved in the drug trade, women who are believed to be involved in the sex trades, women who are labeled with mental illness. Essentially, anyone the officer feels confident will not be believed if she comes forward. And all too often, that actually proves to be true, that people do come forward and complain, and their complaints are dismissed based on stereotypes about Black women being sexually inviolable, on stereotypes about people at many communities being, you know, unbelievable or just not valuable and not credible. And officers prey on that, you know, and I think many of us have heard of Officer Daniel Holtzclaw, who preyed on Black women in Oklahoma City and counted on the fact that they wouldn't come forward or wouldn't be believed when they came forward. And unfortunately, he is unique only in that he was caught and prosecuted and convicted and sentenced. And there are many, many Daniel Holtzclaws around the country who never get caught, or who, when they're caught, are allowed to keep their jobs or just move quietly to another department, and therefore continue to prey on women of color.
Now, your book also focuses very much on how people in the LGBTQ community are targeted. Transgender women in particular face violence in general in society, but of course police violence also targets them. How important is this aspect of looking at police violence? I imagine there may not be statistics on this either, but what can you tell us about the way in which police might be profiling or targeting people of color that are members of the LGBTQ community?
I would say that one, the book is my book, and my work emphatically, you know, is inclusive of transgender women of color as women of color, and that it's important to recognize that, you know, that it's not sort of an isolated group of people, that they are policed as women, but also as gender nonconforming women, right, as trans women. And so, for instance, if we look at the sexual assault statistics that we do have, they are highest among trans women of color. So, for instance, in Los Angeles, a group of Latinx trans women documented their own experiences of police sexual violence and found that at least a quarter of them had experienced some kind of police sexual assault. In Atlanta, Black trans women conducted surveys within their own communities and found similar levels of sexual assault by police officers. So definitely on the higher end for Black trans women and women of color in the question of police sexual assault, in the question of police violence, in the question of police responding to calls for help only to arrest the trans woman. And certainly there are many folks from the trans community who have spoken extensively to this and who are the experts in this area.
Andrea, let's also now spend some time on the very important question of what we do about this. There is a growing prison abolition movement. There is a growing movement to radically reimagine how policing happens in communities, conversations around community policing. But when we focus in and hone in on what how police violence specifically targets women, women of color, Black women, trans women, what are some ways in which police can be held accountable so that we can live in a world where this isn't a thing for women to be targeted by the people that are supposed to be protecting and serving them?
Well, I think, one, we do have to make visible the particular ways in which women experience police violence, like police sexual violence. We certainly can't put an end to it if we're not paying attention to it, or if we're not...
If we're not even acknowledging what's being done, exactly, right?
Exactly. Or trying to pay attention to what circumstances in which it happens. So, for instance, traffic stops are a primary location of police sexual violence. So what are we doing about that? Police explorer programs, like sort of youth programs to engage young people with police, are another primary site of police sexual violence. What are we doing about that?
That's a really important... I don't think I'd ever heard about that. And can you expand on that a little bit?
So some researchers have looked at sort of publicized cases of police sexual violence and found the two sort of most significant sites to be traffic stops and sort of teen explorer programs. So for instance, in Minneapolis, an officer was recently arrested, I believe, for having had sex with a 16-year-old who was involved in an explorer program. That is, there's several examples in my book of young women who were, went on ride-alongs with police officers as part of explorer programs and were sexually assaulted in that context. And so, we give police officers tremendous access to young women in schools, which is another site of police sexual violence, and through these, youth engagement programs, without paying attention to what that kind of power dynamic and what that kind of access can produce. And so that's something that if we pay more attention to where it's happening, we might do something about putting a stop to it. And then I think that we also have to think about what kinds of things give officers power to commit violence against women of color. So as we were talking about earlier, the war on drugs, the ways in which police officers police prostitution is a primary site also of violence against women of color. And so perhaps we need to rethink how we approach those issues. Similarly, police responses to people in mental health crises result in a significant number of police killings every year, and certainly including Black women and women of color. If we came up with a different way of responding to people in mental health crises that didn't involve sending an armed police officer into the situation, we might reduce that violence. And ultimately, I think we just need to look at police responses to domestic violence are another context in which, sadly, Black women and women of color frequently die or experience sexual violence or experience other kinds of police violence or just failure to protect by the police, and which is another form of police violence. And so, and that's particularly true, as I understand it, for trans women who, again, as I said, call the police for protection in domestic violence situations and instead themselves might be arrested for that offense or something else. And if we start looking at where women are experiencing violence it expands our demands, it maybe changes our demands, and it might bring us closer to what you were talking about earlier, which is rethinking the role of police at all in our society, and certainly their role in producing safety, given how much violence and the role they play in perpetrating violence against the people, as you say, that they are framed as being there to protect women and children and LGBTQ people and other people who are, you know, people with mental illness, people who are supposedly vulnerable and who are vulnerable, but who the police are not treating in that way.
Finally, Andrea, are you heartened by Black Lives Matter's growing ability to, share the narrative of how violence impacts women and women of color, and the fact that today we have at our fingertips technology available to document our own experiences so that people don't just have to take us at our word, we can show them how police treat us?
I'm heartened by all of those things. I think that one thing that was significant about Black Lives Matter is not just that women were in leadership of the movement, because that certainly happened before, and then, you know, leadership gets erased, or leadership is only validated if it frames the narrative around men. What I was heartened by is that they explicitly said, we are centering a particular, we are centering women and queer and trans people and other people at the margins of racial justice movements in our narrative. And so I'm heartened by the ways in which that has been moved forward, not only by Black Lives Matter, but groups like BYP 100 and other groups in the larger movement for Black Lives. I'm also heartened by this access to information through social media, because these stories, it's not like they're new. They've always existed, but we always had to count on someone else to think they were important enough to report on, or to include in a report, or to raise as part of a conversation. So for instance, in the report, there's lots of cases of women who testified, for instance, in front of hearings held by the NAACP after the Rodney King beating and uprising. But those testimonies never really rose to the surface as the stories around which we built our analysis and our movements. And now we don't have to depend on an intermediary to do that. We can do that for ourselves. And I think that's produced a significant amount of change. I think the next step, though, is where do we go beyond visibility, and how do we take action given what Black women and women of color's experiences teach us about policing generally, and about the shape of white supremacy and racism in our society, and how we need to imagine new ways of producing safety in our communities.
You're right. The overall framework of white supremacy in this particular political moment is also critical to the story. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
Thanks so much for having me.
My guest has been Andrea J. Ritchie. She is a Black lesbian immigrant and police misconduct attorney, currently the researcher in residence on race, gender, sexuality, and criminalization at the Barnard Center for Research on Women. We've been discussing her new book, Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.